The ultimate thing about white privilege is you don't have to think about it.
This is East End Inc. Tonight we present social justice advocate and author Janet Duarte Bell and civil rights attorney Lewis Steele in a talk about race in American society. This program is one of the online series produced by Caneos Cultural Cafe. Janet Bell and Lewis Steele were introduced by Caneos' Catherine Soka.
We are really honored to have with us this evening Dr. Bell and Lewis Steele. Lewis, as some of you may know, has been a lifelong civil rights attorney. He was associate counsel for the NAACP in the 1960s, and he's continued to work on civil rights cases throughout his long career. He is joined by his good friend, Janet Duarte Bell, who is a communication strategist and a management consultant with a multimedia background, in addition to being a social justice advocate, working with a lot of not-for-profit social justice organizations, and she is also a motivational speaker. She received her doctorate in leadership and change from Antioch University. And she has also helped establish in 2012 the Derrick Bell Fund for Excellence at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. The book that we will be highlighting today from Janet is Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. It's a tremendous addition to all of the books on race over the last several decades. The book really shines light on the women's involvement in the movement in the 60s and the 70s, but it offers invaluable first-person accounts from these women that Janet gleaned through many, many conversations with them over quite a period of time. So anyway, we're in for a treat. We have two very wonderful friends who are going to be in conversation together.
All I want to talk about at the very beginning is the relationship and how it came about between Janet and myself. And talking about that in many ways sets the stage for much that has happened to me in my life. So let me get right with it. I worked for many years at the NAACP in the legal department, and the general counsel there was a man named Robert L. Carter. Carter should be known literally by everyone in America. Next to Thurgood Marshall, he was really the creator and the person who thought through on a very deep level the next moves that the NAACP legal folk could make in order to achieve the victory that they did in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. And so I went to work there in 1964. And by the way, I looked a little different then than I look now looking at myself. Every now and then I pick up my book and say, oh my God, I must have looked very different then. So here I am at the NAACP in 1964, and Robert Carter, who was really a giant in the law, ended up being the man who was my mentor, my teacher, and my lifelong friend. He had a close friend then who was Derrick Bell. Derrick, when I joined the NAACP, was at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, a separate organization, and literally in charge of 300 desegregation cases in the South. When his wife at the time died, he met Janet, and that was in the 1990s, Janet, at some point during the 90s. And Bob Carter used to rent a house in Jamaica where he took his winter vacation as a senior judge on the New York, really on the Federal Court of Appeals sitting in New York. And my wife and I, Kitty, would go down there. And we did that for maybe 4 or 5 years, sometimes in Jamaica, once or twice in Puerto Rico, and a couple times in the United States, and developed a lifelong close relationship with him. He would then have Derek down. And one time Derek was down and he was saying, you know, I've met this woman and she is terrific. And, you know, I've only been unmarried for a year. Is that enough time? Blah, blah, blah. All of us said, yes. And so, of course, Derek and Janet married. Janet joined the little group of friends that Robert Carter had. And that was about 25 years ago. And we became lifelong friends from that time on until this day. So take it away, Janet.
Yes, well, Derek and I actually met on the phone a few months after Jewel Hairston Bell died. And I always lift her up and give her the praise because I said she did the heavy lifting. Derek Bell would not be the Derek Bell we know, but for Jewel Bell being such a fierce and loyal partner. So I'm always appreciative of that. And sometimes when I first started talking about it, it made some people uncomfortable. I said, well, that's on them. It's not on me, because I always lift her up. And I feel because she not only gave Derek permission to get remarried, she gave him instructions. She said, you need a partner. This is hard work that you're doing out here. So she had set that up. And so I am grateful for that. So we met in 1990, in person in 1991, and we married in 1992, and we were together every day after that. And the Steels have been such wonderful people. First of all, you know, this story would not be complete without Robert L. Carter, as he said it. And Bob Carter's first wife, late wife, he never remarried, Gloria Carter. First of all, our youngest son is named after Gloria and Robert Carter. Some people sometimes say it's after Robert Carter. No, it's after both of them. Carter, Robeson, Bell. You know the significance of that. Those names, of course. And so she, I discovered, had encouraged Kitty Muldoon Steele to pursue her education at a relatively mature age. And Kitty Muldoon Steele then encouraged me, and when I was in my 50s, to pursue my education. And that was a little negotiation with Derek on that, because I, you know, I had gone back to school after we were married to get my master's, and you know, and that was hard because he was so busy, I was busy, and so it was a sacrifice really on his part. But he supported it. But Kitty pushed me into that. And I got my doctorate 5 years ago. And I always forget what age I was. I think it was about 68. You know, I always forget how old I am. And so I always say that Kitty Steele, I acknowledge both the Steeles, but particularly Kitty, in both my dissertation and in my book. But for their support and their love and encouragement, I would not have accomplished a lot of the things. And so it's interesting, over the last few years, the kinds of things that have really helped me to fulfill what I think was Derek's legacy, you know, with the Bell Lecture at NYU. And we never upgraded the bio. So it's really the 25th year. The 25th anniversary is this fall, and there is a book being published by the New Press on it. And it will have the first 24 lectures, because the 25th lecture will not be until this fall. But it's really, I mean, the friendship with the Steeles and the Carters is very deep and long. And what it does, what it says to me is that, and we didn't agree on everything. We agreed on the basic things in terms of character and values and social justice and things like that. But the evenings that we have spent, which were long days, journeys into night, we would spend arguing over all sorts of things. And it was just the most wonderful experience in the world, which I wish everyone could experience.
So, Janet, do you want to talk a little bit about the women that you wrote about and,
oh, yes,
and why you did that? I just would, before you get into it, the one thing I'd like to throw out to you on this is certainly when I started at the NAACP in the 60s, that was a male-dominated organization. And all through the 60s and 70s, the Black Power Movement, SNCC, whatever organization was out there, CORE, was always at the top male-dominated. And today, I see a tremendous change. I see the Me Too movement, I see Black Lives Matter, and I see women as the leadership in all those organizations. And I'm wondering if you can weave that into the story you've told in your book.
Well, I always say that the organizations and the Black men were of their time. So I never really criticize them strongly. But what I say is that women were not given the due that they should have. And I look at people. So, for example, at the March on Washington, women did not speak from the main stage, right? But behind the scenes, there were women, Josephine Baker, who even though she was living in France at the time, really was did not forget her Harlem roots. She was just an activist. And of course, there was Merle Evers, and there were all these other fabulous women. The women I interviewed in my book included my favorite is, and so I know you're not supposed to have favorite among children, but my favorite interview was Merle Evers. I just say it just like that. I just start off there. But the other women I interviewed included Kathleen Cleaver of the Black Panthers, one of the sweetest, smartest people you'll ever meet in life, and just generous of spirit. Judy Richardson of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who later became the series associate producer of Eyes on the Prize. Eileen Hernandez, who was the first Black African-American to be president of the National Organization for Women. And sadly, I think she was the last. And though, so there are many others. I want, and Leah Chase, who died just last year, I think it was, who was the proprietor of Duke Chase's restaurant in New Orleans, Louisiana, and who really built that family business, her husband's family business, into a powerhouse, and who I say when I speak particularly to the young people, she's better known by people who follow the James Beard Foundation than as a civil rights leader. And so when I interviewed her, she was surprised that someone wanted to talk about her civil rights contributions, and she was indefatigable. She just wanted to talk for hours, and my video, I did video this, and he and I, after a few hours, we're sort of passing out, and she's still talking. And she was telling us how during those times, of course, when they would host meetings of integrated groups, which was totally against the law, their business could have been raided and shut down at any point. And thank goodness it was not, because of the stature of the Chase family in that community. So even though New Orleans sort of has this, you know, laissez les bon temps rouler, let the good times roll vibe, you know, it was still the heart of segregation. So I interviewed these women and I let them talk. I wanted to lift up their voices, let them sing their songs. So I just feel that it was a privilege and an honor. I fell in love with each and every one. The reason I say that Merle Evers is my favorite is that, you know, her husband was assassinated in their driveway in 1963. He was the head of the NAACP in the state of Mississippi. He was a field director. She was the secretary. Now, secretary didn't mean you were taking dictation. Secretary of the NAACP meant, as with the women who were behind the scenes in the NAACP and the legal defense offices in New York, meant that you were strategists, you were planning events, that you were doing a lot of the heavy lifting, what have you. And so in 1963, when he was assassinated in his driveway, Mrs. Evers, and I always called her that. She said, call me Merle. But I grew up in a house where my mouth can't even work that. I cannot call her by her first name. I always call her Mrs. Evers. And she talks about one of the most poignant things that she says. She stayed in that house, by the way, for a year and a half through the time when, from 63 to 64, when the three civil rights workers, Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, were killed by the Klan. And by the way, the Klan, it's not just the Klan, these were all police officers who killed them. As David Goodman, who was on a program I produced a couple weeks ago, said, this was state-sanctioned murder. She stayed in that house. And then after a while, she just had to go. Her aunt said, go as far away as you can. So she took her three small children and she moved to California, where she went back to school at age 31, got her degree and all that sort of thing. But what she says to me in the book, she talks about that you walk with death. You know, we knew that it was coming. You walk with death and death walks with you. She talks about role playing. What would happen if my husband were killed?
But let me pick up on that a little bit. We're now a whole bunch of years away from there. And it strikes me that on a very fundamental level, we're dealing with the same issues now as we were dealing then. By the way, 1963, I was volunteering for the NAACP when that assassination took place. And I've got to tell you, Bob Carter started sending me down south the next year. And I had to deal with, oh my God, this is very different than what I thought life would be like as a civil rights lawyer. But I soon learned how heroic the people who ran the NAACP were down there. And it gave me lots of inspiration. The point, though, that I'd like to make is that when you look at some of the deaths of young Black people now, both men and women, the recent terrible resolution of the killing in Louisville, the killings in Wisconsin, the killings all over the country, with the police getting literally protection from district attorneys, from grand juries, from never getting punished for what they did, which is exactly what happened, of course, in the Evers case. So what you see is stagnation, in my view, going all the way back from the late 60s until today on so many levels. Less school integration now than there was years ago, in fact. Housing segregation is more impacted now than ever. Jobs, wherever you look, you see the same pattern.
Except now I'm going to see. This is why we're such good friends, because we interrupt each other. I'm going to interrupt you now, because I think that what is hopeful about this moment is that you have an integrated group of people doing these protests. And I know you did. I know it happened in the '60s as well, because I was there. But I think that what you have now is people understanding that what we're dealing with is a system that needs to be changed. That system is called white supremacy. So that to me is hopeful.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact,
But let me also say too, because I want to say about my book. My book is a hopeful book. And the stories of these women, what they really talk about is that they, and I summarize it in three words, which are totally inadequate, but I talk about their authenticity, their courage, and their purpose. And so I think that I don't want to leave that, because, you know, Bryan Stevenson, you all, maybe you know of him now, Equal Justice Initiative. You know, he says, because hopelessness is the enemy of social justice. So I am a hope meister. I'm always moving to bend that arc of justice, you know, the arc of the universe toward justice.
The issue that I see still arising out of what's occurring now, especially when I look at all the white kids, I understand if you're black and you've been subjected to the really constant drumbeat of racial discrimination and the killings, you are going to be angry and willing to demonstrate and willing to press as hard as you can. But to see the white kids out there initially was a surprise to me. I've now seen it for, 2, 3, 4 weeks as these demonstrations have gone on since the Floyd killing. It raises only one issue with me. Probably should raise more, but the one issue is, will those kids at some point get a broad understanding as white people, what white privilege they have that the blacks and the browns especially that are demonstrating with them don't have?
The ultimate thing about white privilege is you don't have to think about it.
Well, that's right.
Black people have to think, when my son walks out, or even Derek, I mean, there was an incident in front of our fancy building on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, where a police officer, it was almost a tragic incident, but we got through it. But what happened was, we were returning from, I mean, this is like a privileged scenario, right? We were returning from our then country home in the Catskills, in the mountains, what we love. And we did like everybody else did in our building. We double parked to, you know, unload from the weekend. And this young police officer came up and he told us to move. And Derek said, who's a very gracious, lovely gentleman. I mean, gentleman par excellence, right, Lewis? I mean, just the best. And he said, well, we're just moving. And we were in the car. And so the guy says, no, when I tell you to move, this young police officer said, when I tell you to move, you move. And he walked toward the driver's side where Derek was. He had his hand on his gun. And Derek, like, opened the door. And I said, no, Derek, hands up, hands up. And I said, Derek, hands up. At that point, our doorman, who happened to be Latino, runs out and he goes, Dr. Bell, Dr. Bell. And it was only then the police officer stopped. And it's like, oh, well, he's just not your regular person. I might get in trouble if something happens like that. and he backed away. And I said to Derek, and Derek said, well, that shouldn't be that way. I said, Derek, you know better than that. Hands up, don't shoot, even though they may shoot.
So the thought that that leaves me with is, here we are, you've described a scene that could have occurred 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago, 5 years ago, and still occurs now on a regular basis. And you have, perhaps for the first time since the 60s, when the civil rights laws got passed, 64, 65, 69, for the first time, you have blacks, whites, browns, young people, old people marching together in the thousands in the streets, which is a hopeful sign. Although when we think of the election, we see the people generally, not the marchers at all, but people who come into those demonstrations precisely to create a racist backlash. But you have to look at those demonstrations. You say those white people are out there for the first time in literally decades. How can we work with them to keep them in the fold, to keep them focused so they will react not when a police officer puts his knee on somebody's neck for, what, 4 minutes, but just when he does exactly what you told us with regard to the story with Derek, and treat that as something that must stop and that will not stop until the society demands that it stops.
This is East End Inc. We heard social justice advocate and author Janet Wark Bell in conversation with civil rights attorney Lewis Steele. The complete discussion is available at Canio Books' YouTube channel. Janet Bell's book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement, was published by New Press in 2018. Lewis Steele's book, The Butler's Child, White Privilege, Race, and a Lawyer's Life in Civil Rights, was published this year by the University of South Carolina Press. Upcoming free literary events produced by the nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe are online and are listed in the calendar of events at canios.com. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday of each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callendrill and Catherine Soga.